Just last year, a very, very fine couple, friends of mine, parents of a large family, very devout, worked all their lives in the church, were killed in a tragic automobile accident, which was in no way their fault. They were struck by a youngster who was without a license and driving many miles in an hour over the speed limit, and who I think also was intoxicated. I just say, why? Why didn't they leave 2 minutes later? Why didn't the youngster get a flat tire? Why? During last year, a very fine young woman I knew, mother of five children, I knew her since she was a little girl, living down in a very poor section of the inner city, died of AIDS. Her first husband had been murdered at the doorstep of their modest home by a hitman who had the wrong address. And her second husband gave her two children and AIDS. Why? Why? I spoke to a very fine young woman not long ago who as a child had been subject to all kinds of abuse in a satanic cult. She had actually been scarred. I talked to people who as children were abused in a variety of ways, tragic, heartbreaking ways. And sometimes I have talked on a couple of occasions to the people who abused them and who must live the rest of their lives with that horrible memory, that terrible guilt on their shoulders. Often these were people who started out life and lived most of their lives with goodwill and never intended to hurt anybody. Why? Why do such terrible things happen to innocent, to good people? And you know, if you live long enough, something tragic is going to happen to you. That's reality. Anne Morrow Lindberg, in her very moving book, Days of Gold, Days of Lead, writing about the years in which her husband had a great triumph and also the years in which she mourned for the death of her little kidnapped child. Mrs. Lindberg says something to the effect that into every life comes tragedy and sorrow. Not into every life comes horror, but into enough lives, horror comes. Why? Why? Now, if I could answer this question totally and adequately, you'd be watching the beginning of the greatest TV series in the history of the world. That's not what I'm going to do. If someone could have given a resounding, cogent answer that everybody understood easily to the question of why evil happens in the world, that person was our Lord Jesus Christ. And it is my belief that in his life he gave that answer, but that the answer requires faith and prayer and meditation and at least an attempt at a devout life in order to understand it. One day I was driving past a home in the suburbs, and there were police cars and an ambulance and neighbors standing on the front lawn in this suburban neighborhood. And as I came by, I looked at the name on the mailbox, and it was an Italian-sounding name, so I thought, oh, these people must be Catholics. Perhaps they would like to see a priest, whatever happened. And I stopped, and I said to one of the neighbors, what happened? And she said, oh, there was a crib death. I said, I think the people are probably Catholic. And she said, they are. So I walked carefully into the house. I was dressed as I am now. And there was a young woman crying, surrounded by her relatives, trying to console her. And she saw me, and she jumped up, and she grabbed my robe here and pulled it and tore it right down the middle. And she said, why? Why? That wasn't a question. She was angry. She was angry at God. She was angry at life. She was angry at herself. Why? Obviously, that was not the moment for me to give a lecture on the problem of evil or the problem of death. But the question has always been in my mind, why? And so I decided I would try to do a series, and I did it in different churches last year, and I'm doing it this year on EWTN, and if it works, we'll make it into a book, and if the book sells, we'll make it into a Broadway musical. Why? But really, seriously, here's the reason why I decided to take it up. St. Gregory the Great, a pope who lived at the beginning of the Dark Ages, a terribly difficult time, writes, "It is the characteristic of believers that their own painful trials do not make them lose their concern for the well-being of others. They are grieved by the adversity they must endure, but they watch out for others and teach them needed lessons. They are like careful physicians who themselves are stricken and lie ill. They suffer wounds themselves, but they bring others the medicine that would restore health." Many of you have become television friends of mine. It's a funny kind of relationship. I'll be walking through an airport and somebody will come up and say, "Oh, didn't I see you on EWTN? Or, are you Father Rutler?" No, Father Rutler's a dear friend of mine, but we don't look one little bit alike. But I'll say, "Oh, you watch EWTN." One lady said to me recently, "Why, I spend an hour every day talking to you." I said, "I'm sorry, I can't see you back through the camera." But I have a concern, an affection for the people who watch EWTN. I wish I could answer all their mail. It's not even humanly possible. And so I decided to take up this most difficult of topics. What do you do when life does not make sense? This is an answer for believers. Rabbi Kushner wrote an answer for those who believe in the Jewish scriptures. He borrowed much of his answer from the book of Job. And that answer is available for any of us. But I have to go beyond that because I'm talking to an audience of people who largely have built their lives on the New Testament, not that they have ignored the Old. "Oh, I love the Old Testament answer. Those marvelous passages around the 40th chapter of the book of Job, when the Lord shows up after Job has had all these troubles and he says, 'Job, what do you know? Did you make the heavens, the earth? Did you set up the foundations of the sea? Were you there when the sky was made? What do you know? You're going to question me?' And Job, in humility, stops before the mighty hand of God, before the incredible mind of God, and gives thanks to God. It's a very good answer. But it is not the answer on which the Christian must build their response. Recently, many of us were struck by the tragic death of the great tennis star, tennis champion, Arthur Ashe. I didn't know Mr. Ashe. I don't think I've ever watched a whole tennis game. But I was very struck by Mr. Ashe and a talk that he gave, which was quoted in the Times, at the Niagara County Community College when he was dying of AIDS, which he had contracted in a medical procedure. Mr. Ashe wrote, "I've had a religious faith growing up in the South and black and having the church as a focal point of my life. And I was reminded of something Jesus said on the cross, 'My God, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Mr. Ashe continues, remember, Jesus was poor and humble, of a despised minority. And Jesus asked the question, in effect, why must the innocent suffer? And I'm not so innocent. I mean, I'm hardly a perfect human being. And you ask about yourself, why me? And then I think, why not me? Why should I be spared what some others have been inflicted with? I have to think of all the good things in my life. Why me? Sometimes there are no explanations for things, especially for things that are bad. I thought that was a tremendous witness to give at a secular college. And it speaks of a deep, abiding Christian faith, which we find among many, many ordinary people in the United States of different races and nationalities and religious denominations. I've been struck by the fact in my own work that when people face sorrow or evil, they have a great ecumenical experience. Pain and suffering are the most ecumenical experience in the world because they put every one of us where we ought to be, if we are Christians, on our knees before the crucifix, before the image of Jesus crucified. I know it is not common for Protestant people to have a crucifix. Catholic and Orthodox Christians will have not only a cross, but an image of Jesus on the cross. I would say to everyone, it would be a wise idea to at least have a copy of perhaps a great painting of the crucifixion. My favorite one is by the Lutheran artist Matthias Grunewald, Matthew Greenwood, if you put his name into English, from Colmar in Alsace. And his great crucifixion shows Christ's body twisted in agony, gray, the terrible holes in his hands and feet. He looks like some gigantic insect torn apart in this ancient painting. And standing at the foot of the cross, very peacefully, is the Lamb of God. The Christian answer to the problem of evil is not an argument. It is not a statement. It's a response to a person. Peter Kraft, as a philosopher at Boston College, in his book on the meaning of suffering, he states very, very clearly that for the Christian, the answer is not why. The question is not why, but who. And I want you to think about this. First of all, bear in mind that life is very mysterious, that we're not going to come up with any easy, obvious answer to this question, which everybody can buy. St. Paul in the Epistle to the Romans says, oh, the depths of the riches of the wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable are his judgments, how inscrutable his ways. For who has known the mind of the Lord, or who has been his counselor? Who has given a gift to him to receive in return? For from him and through him and to him are all things. To him be glory and honor forever. God is mysterious. And if you haven't figured this out already, life is very mysterious. Some reason or other, we shield children from this mysteriousness, although they obviously don't want to be shielded. Children very much enjoy watching programs about tragedy. They watch programs about difficulties and accidents and monsters and things like that in some kind of an attempt to deal with the fact that life doesn't make a lot of sense. And perhaps modern children in this day are more even prone to violence, and sadly enough, are induced into violence by so much entertainment, because they live in a violent and paganistic world. We have become like the ancient Romans, who amused themselves watching gladiators kill each other. Now our gladiators are mostly actors. Why? Why is life like this? Why are there green hills and blue skies and beautiful babies and lovely, venerable old people? Why are there magnificent scenes and fascinating animals in the forest? Why? And life has terrible tragedies like some of the ones that I just mentioned to you. It doesn't make sense, does it? William Blake, the poet, writing a poem about lambs and tigers, says to the tiger, "Did he who made the lamb make thee?" I have a very good friend who's a monk. I'm a friar, I'm not a monk. Friars are kind of monks in the midst of the city and the world, but he's a monk in the more traditional sense out in the countryside at a boys' school, and he wrote a bookmark one time. It hasn't been published, but maybe we should. God is mysterious. Adam and Eve messed things up. Jesus called Peter his enemy and Judas friend. And Jesus got crucified. And you thought this was going to be a picnic? We're all in the soup together. And this is where we begin with the Christian answer. The Christian answer begins kneeling at the foot of the cross. We should not shield children from the fact that life is going to be difficult and puzzling, mysterious, sorrowful, and sometimes even horrific, as Mrs. Lindbergh said. Don't ever pretend at a graduation from grammar school or high school that is all a marvelous new world. The youngsters will just laugh at you. They know that that's not true. They knew it wasn't true when they were 5 years old. Pollyanna's a silly story that children read at a silly time. No, they know what's going on. But this is where you must bring them to the image of Jesus crucified. Mr. Ashe, in that little speech he gave at the community college, said, "The words that are going through my mind, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" Jesus Christ, Son of God, the most innocent, the most perfect, the most kindly, the most truthful human being who ever lived, Son of God and Son of Man, died naked on a cross, with nails driven through his members, with a spear thrown into his side. And usually the paintings that you see of the crucifixion are much too nice. They're kind of an artistic tableau. There's nothing a tableau about them at all. It was a hideous, miserable, rotten thing for people to do. The place where Jesus was crucified was covered with flies. The ground was drenched with human blood of human beings crucified there, or stoned to death. It was a hideous death. There was nothing artistic or beautiful about it at all. And when his mother's sister, Mary the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene, the other women, stood beneath the cross, they must have all been thinking the same thing. This doesn't make sense. How could the most innocent person who ever lived, who went around miraculously healing the sick and even raising the dead, how could he be brought to this? How could it happen? And that's where you and I must kneel down in the presence of the problem of evil. I want you to know, brothers and sisters, that I had to work on this all my life. Because I belonged to the friars, and it was a duty and ideal of friars to work with people who are poor and unfortunate, I've often dealt with life in its very seamiest forms. I know people who've done all kinds of things, people that the whole world would consider the most disreputable sinners, people, some of them professional, most of them very unfortunate and poor, people condemned to prison before they ever set foot on earth. I know these people, and I've had to work so many times on this question. Where I was chaplain long ago in Children's Village in Dobbs Ferry, we had a very bright Hispanic boy. And the worst thing ever happened to him that could happen to a Hispanic youngster, his mother ran away on the family. And he didn't know what to do. His mind shivered and shattered. His dad was a very good, devout man, but he couldn't make up for a mother. And this boy eventually left us, and at the age of 16, took a dose of rat poison. And it didn't kill him. He ran down the streets later when he recovered, waving a pistol. And a police officer, seeing him waving the pistol at the crowd, shot him and killed him. The police officer was devastated. But a 16-year-old boy waving a gun is as dangerous as anybody waving a gun. He came to the funeral. He apologized to the boy's father. And his father said, "It wasn't your fault." And I stood by the casket in the church in Upper Manhattan. And I said, "God, how could you let this happen? Here's a youngster who had very little in life, and to be brought to such a tragic end." And I had to look at the crucifix. I was saying the funeral mass of the girl who died of AIDS. I told you about her at the beginning of the program. Her name was Peggy. And I was so annoyed. How could this happen? That my heart was like a stone. The little Puerto Rican family was gathered there in St. Cecilia's. They were crying. Her own children were crying. I had given them little notes she had written. And as I began the mass, the sunlight was coming through the stained glass windows on the window of the crucifixion. And I kept looking at that window as I offered the Mass. And toward the end of the Mass, the sun had moved. And it was shining through the next window, which is the window of the resurrection. The window of God's mysterious and absolute triumph over evil. I wish I could share that answer with everyone listening to me. Every one of you who is listening to me now has had tragedy in your life and sorrow. Everyone. During this series in which I talk about the failure of friends, the loss of death, the failure of the church, the failure of our security, I'm going to always come back to the same scene. I'm going to come back to Jesus Christ, the Son of God, God's beloved Son. God says, "This is my beloved Son." And I'm going to come back to his body writhing in pain on the cross. At least we know that God has not left us alone. In a world made mysterious by evil, he has suffered evil with us.